Welcome to How to Fix It. I'm John Avlon, author, journalist, recent congressional candidate, and this podcast is all about finding solutions to the problems we face, not just fixating on the problems. And our guest today, Andrew Yang, has been an advocate for focusing on solutions, and a very far-sighted one at that. He, in his 2020 presidential campaign and in a book that preceded it called The War on Normal People, was warning about the impact of AI to our democracy, to our economy. Things that might have seemed hypothetical at that time are now upon us. So we want to talk to him about solutions, the state of where we stand, the impact of AI on our democracy and our economy, and what we can do about it. Andrew, it's great to see you, man. Thanks for joining.
Hey, John. Great to be with you, and congrats on a phenomenal campaign.
Well, thanks, brother. When you and I first met, it was 2018, before The War on Normal People came out. I was editor-in-chief of The Daily Beast, and I think we had the distinction of actually publishing an excerpt before anybody else. And this was really long ball stuff. I mean, you were talking about things that you saw coming down the pike clearly, but seemed really hypothetical. And in a recent blog post, you wrote, what 4 years ago was hypothetical is now immediate. So what is the state of AI as it's impacting our, let's start with our democracy right now?
Social media has splintered the news that people get and the reality they experience. And then AI now is bolting itself onto our social media in various ways. I mean, a lot of the social media companies are using algorithms that are fueled by AI. Some creators are now using AI images, unfortunately. There are even now AI influencers out there. And when I wrote The War on Normal People, I was focused on the economic impacts. I thought that we were going to eliminate, for example, 2 million call center jobs that are, by the way, now very, very much going to be eliminated, and that this was going to be an outgrowth of the trends that brought Trump to office in 2016, where we had automated away about 4 million manufacturing jobs that were primarily in the Rust Belt prior to 2016, and a lot of that was not AI. But what I thought was going to happen was that AI was going to supercharge the displacement of a lot of blue-collar workers. When I was in Iowa 5 years ago, I would talk about truck drivers. And, you know, I was a little early on that, but I was a little bit late on a lot of the white-collar work that large language models are already displacing right now, which includes a lot of writers. I mean, I hate to say that, or journalists, but, you know, it's like content creators, designers, a lot of knowledge work, management consulting, like you name it. And I was not in Iowa talking about management consultants. I was talking about call center workers and truck drivers. The drivers, I mean, that's unfolding too. If you go out to certain cities, there are Waymo driverless cars everywhere. And trust me when I say Uber is very focused on this. So AI was more speculative 4 or 5 years ago. It's now rampaging through the economy in various ways. And it's something that you focus on a lot. It has already helped to splinter our media universe and thus our democratic processes.
I mean, in profound ways. And already, I mean, there's sort of a, what appears to be a power grab on the part of a lot of the people who are the CEOs or owners of these platforms within the government. And without sort of any, you know, recognition of sort of normal constitutional or legal processes, what's your read on that at this particular moment?
Well, what happened was that there are mega tech companies that see the AI boom and say, oh my gosh, like, you know, we have to be leaders in this. And so, you know what that means? We have to spend tens of billions of dollars on either the compute infrastructure or our own large language models. And there's like an AI arms race. And what they've done is they've gone to the government and said, you need to help us because it's either us or China. And then the government said, well, of course, we must help you. And so those tech CEOs in particular have now accrued hundreds of billions of dollars in market cap because everyone feels like, well, shoot, I can't be left behind in this AI boom. Which of these companies is going to win? What's going to be one of this handful? So let me pile into Microsoft. Let me pile into Meta. Let me pile into Alphabet/Google. And then those tech CEOs look up and say, who's in charge? You're in charge? All right. Well, like, let me get your help and your buy-in, and it's us versus China, et cetera, et cetera. I will say that, let's say a Democrat had won, like a Kamala had won, a lot of the tech CEOs would be right there too, saying, hey, you know, like, let's help America win. I mean, I see a lot of those folks as fairly pragmatic. You know, I'm not sure if you're referencing specifically Elon, who is now in something of a feud with Sam Altman over OpenAI and the direction that's taken, where OpenAI is now very much a for-profit company and is working hand-in-hand with Microsoft. Now, I will say that the DeepSeek revelation has called into question a lot of what I've just described, because if you're going to spend tens of billions of dollars on compute infrastructure and then have a Chinese company essentially rip it off and do it cheaper, and it's more energy efficient and you don't need the NVIDIA super chips and like all of the rest of it, then people are saying, like, wait a minute, was that the necessary investment? Was that the approach? But the, let's call it, you know, multi-hundred billion dollar investment is still on.
In the urgency of this moment, there seems to be a, we want less guardrails around the technology to keep up the competitiveness, but the net result seems to be kind of a crony capitalism as opposed to what you've argued for, which is a human-centric capitalism. Discuss what that is, and then let's go to the universal basic income, which is one of your signature OG platforms.
Yeah, so this AI is being built upon the backs of our data. And I'm actually going to share something with you, John, that you might have gotten the same thing. Check it out. But one of my publishers reached out to me and said, hey, one of the AI companies wants to use your book to train large language models, and they're offering us a little bit of money, and we'll split the money with you. And then I looked at that and was like, well, snap, I guess this is happening, and I might as well take my little scraps because it's going to happen, right, with or without my particular writings. And, like, you know, there's also a little bit of like, ooh, like my writings will be like one scintilla of that AI. I mean, but they're being built on the backs of our data, publicly available data, of a lot of data that, you know, folks certainly haven't been compensated for. And then who's gotten rich? The tech companies, their shareholders, their leadership. And so what I was arguing for in the day was, look, even now, by the way, even putting AI aside, just based on targeting data, our data is getting sold and resold for hundreds of billions of dollars a year. And so one of the things I used to say on the campaign trail was like, does anyone remember getting your data check in the mail? And then people would have a laugh. And then I would say data is the new oil and Alaska. Everyone there gets paid for their oil. Why can't we all get paid for our data? And my thesis on this, John, was that AI was going to come and it was going to make everyone very sad and upset unless people felt like they were benefiting. And right now the benefits are accruing to the hands of the few and not the many. And so that was my argument, was for ownership rights of our data. And then if anyone wanted to use our data, let's say to build large language models or whatever, then we would all be, you know, micro owners.
What laws would need to be passed to bring about that kind of shift in the fundamental economy around AI?
You would need to have ownership rights of our data, regardless of how it gets used. And by the way, California actually passed a state law that moved in this direction where the tech companies was concerned. So Californians now do have some data rights that most of the rest of us don't. And then I think maybe one or two other states followed their lead. So you would need federal legislation saying, hey, it turns out that our data was ours all along. And that anyone that uses it or benefits monetarily from it has to come to some agreement. Now, the problem there is that who negotiates that agreement? And so in theory, what you would do is you'd have different data collectives that would say, hey, let me negotiate for the best deal possible for you. In theory, the government could fill that role. In another theory, you could have data unions. So there are some things to be ironed out, but it's 100% doable. It would just require like a very forward-thinking government. Now, what's happened with California, so they passed this law and the tech companies fought it tooth and nail. And then different states looked at it and said, hey, maybe we'll do a piece of this, maybe we'll do a piece of that. So we should know that because this would fundamentally alter the business model of tech companies, they're lobbying furiously against it. And a lot of the legislators are very scared of having tech companies come and drop gajillions of dollars against them. The fact that California passed this was a little bit of an anomaly because a private group managed to, you know, get some legislators animated, and then it passed before the tech companies could, you know, spring into action.
Who are the legislators that have been the biggest advocates for this kind of thing in Congress or the Senate today?
Wow. Today in the Congress and Senate, I actually haven't even talked to him about this, but I'm sure he's totally on board, is like a new member named George Whitesides, mm-hmm. who's a member of Congress out of California. And he's sort of a techie by background. So I'm sure he'd be very, very keen on this. You know, Ro Khanna might be a leader on this, who represents Silicon Valley. And I say this somewhat speculatively because I confess there has not been a groundswell of congressional leadership around trying to get everyone's data as a property right. There has been some privacy legislation, which is related, and there were about half a dozen efforts there. There have been different attempts at solving the problem in different ways.
Susan DelBene has a piece of legislation around that, Democrat of Washington State, actually original Microsoft employee.
Oh, yeah, that would be good. Look at that, man. That would make sense. Someone from the tech industry would be like, yo, we're doing some very, very aggressive stuff, shall we say.
But what you're talking about is this train is barreling down on us. It's upon us, and it creates an opportunity for a very different kind of populist movement than the one Donald Trump has tapped into, although it may feed off the same anxieties. But it's a fundamental shift in the way we think about our economy. If people are being compensated for their data,
yeah,
that's a dramatic shift. How is that different than the universal basic income, UBI, that you've proposed, which I will note, and I want to press you on the inflationary impacts. I know it's a question you get a lot, but was something originally proposed by people, including Milton Friedman, who was the father of free markets, free trade, who apparently has been booted out of the rightward-leaning movement under Donald Trump. So, I mean, if a guy like Milton Friedman could get behind UBI, you'd think that would help build bridges. But explain what that is and how it would work and how it relates to the data rights.
Well, first I'm going to tell a funny story, John, that only you would be able to relate to. So it was a few years ago. I'm working at CNN. You're working at CNN. We're like hanging out. Mm-hmm. And then CNN comes and pitches me on a TV show called The Future Of with Andrew Yang. It's like the future of healthcare, the future of transportation. And I was like, oh, interesting. Yeah, let's look at it. So then they go off and do some research. And then they come back and say, hey, Andrew, bad news. People don't like the future.
That's so good. I mean, first of all, everyone should have an interest in the future because it's where you're going to spend the rest of your life. And I love that some focus group or polling kicked that back. So we're just going to ignore it. That seems like a smart decision.
What's happening is the future is making people sad, John. And like people sense that the train is leaving the station and they're not on the train. And they're like, what the hell's going on? And a lot of that is they don't feel like their family circumstances are improving. Mm-hmm. They don't feel like their kids are going to leave the house and get married and, like, you know, do all the stuff that maybe they hoped for. So, by the way, the U.S. citizenry is about 35% college grads and 65% non. And so the most common jobs in the U.S. economy are clerical and administrative, which includes call centers, retail, food service, food prep, truck driving and transportation, manufacturing. Those jobs are about half of the economy. And AI and the like are going to do a number on it, on all of those. And you can go through them if you'd like, and you know, in your head. And so where does this go? So universal basic income is one approach that it wasn't something I came up with. I mean, Martin Luther King advocated for it. Milton Friedman, there were other people with different versions of it. And I'll talk about UBI for just a moment. So our economy now is up to something like $28, $29 trillion. And AI is going to increase that. It's like AI is going to do some very, very nasty things, honestly. But it is going to increase GDP. I mean, you can be fairly confident in that. Then you look around and say, huh, could you alleviate and address gross poverty and just start everyone at something like $12,000 a year? And like, would that save you money on healthcare, education, incarceration, homelessness? It's something that, in my mind, is coming, is inevitable. AI is going to eat a lot of things between now and then, and not just blue collar, obviously. I mean, it's eating white collar work faster, especially if you consider customer service white collar. But a lot of the entry level positions might not be there, like the professional service firms aren't hiring like they used to, et cetera, et cetera. So UBI, in my mind, is inevitable. But one of the things I'm very, very open to is something like a negative income tax. It's like, hey, we're not going to start giving everyone universal basic income, but if you make below a certain level, we're going to true you up. to, it's called the poverty line, which is something like, 19 or 20,000 a person. And then that obviously only affects people who make less than that. Another cousin to universal basic income is the enhanced child tax credit, which you and I have spoken about. Mm-hmm. And this is something that lifted millions of American kids out of poverty in 2021. And 130 economists said we should keep doing this. So I'm not like a dogmatic UBI guy. I'm a get money into the hands of the deeply impoverished as quickly as possible guy. And I'm open to different ways to do that. If someone looks at increasing the minimum wage, and like I remember when I was running for president, people were like, where are you on that? It's like, well, I prefer this other thing. But in a vacuum, if you say, hey, do you want to increase the minimum wage? Yeah, sure. You know, it's like anything that gets money into the hands of the working poor. Or the non-working poor I'm into.
So the goal here, at least from my frame of mind, is how do we strengthen and stabilize our democracy at a time of massive change that is going to disaggregate a lot of folks, at least in the short term, right? Every industrial revolution, there are winners and there are losers, but new industries are created. This is something fundamentally different. So there should be a patriotic urgency around this. And the Indiana tax credit you described was put in place by Bill Clinton. Child tax credit you fought for was briefly in place, cut childhood poverty in half, was not renewed. But one of the new things that's happened since you ran is there's an increased appreciation for the enormously regressive impacts of inflation, right? And along with a bigger problem with debt. And what I'm just curious about is how the increase in the debt and the cost of the debt and the increased awareness of the pain of inflation changes your approach to UBI. Or are you just saying, look, it's actually not an issue?
Well, this is something that deeply pains me, John, because, I run for president, COVID hits. Everyone's like, oh, we have to do something. And then we printed about $6 trillion in response to COVID in the multiple relief acts. And we did send out cash relief checks, which if you do the math, the average American might have received something like $2,900, maybe, along those lines. Like the average American received about 17% of the $6 trillion we printed. So then what happened to the other 83%? We sent it to states, cities. We pumped up the stock market. There was a massive wealth transfer to everyone who is a shareholder because we said, oh, can't let anything happen to them. And so then people look up and say there is inflation, which there has been, and everyone blames the relief checks. And it's like, well, like, would you blame the 17% or would you blame the 83% on that one? You know what I mean? And so then everyone's share prices continued to go up. And then inflation hit, and then the poor suffer. So it pains me deeply that everyone looks and is like, oh, you know, money in people's hands, that was a problem. It's like, no, it wasn't really it. It was like I think it was all the other stuff we did. And here we are. By the way, the deprivation is now worse than ever. I mean, you know, it's like you can see that. So are there things that need to be done in terms of reining in costs and like finding efficiencies in our government? 100%. Is there a lot of room, even if you're very concerned about government spending and the deficit, to do more for the neediest among us? Yeah, there's totally a lot more that we could and should do. And you point out that the enhanced child tax credit, you know, got undone in 2022. That was heartbreaking because that was something that we were clearly doing that was working. Kids were learning more. There was less domestic violence. Like there are all these things where you look at it and be like, oh, like that was a good thing. And there's room for good things, even with some cost consciousness.
You're speaking to the impulse sometimes, you know, the phrase is often, you know, we socialize losses and privatize profits. But the government action seems geared towards big corporations, not towards the working families, the working poor. And they're the first ones to sort of get cut. The larger danger, of course, is something, you know, these are historical forces the founding fathers were aware of. If you've got really cavernous gaps between the richest and the poorest, that's destabilizing for society. So as you go back and you make this amended case for UBI, how do you address those critics who say, well, it hasn't really proved itself? And to say, look, we have an interest in making sure that our economy works for the working poor. Otherwise, we are in deep trouble. And, you know, my belief is we need to make sure we need to do everything we can to rebuild the strong and stable middle class, that's been hollowing out our politics.
Yeah, so in the simplest terms, John, you have a nation which either has a mindset of abundance and growth and optimism, or a mindset of scarcity and pessimism And if someone else is doing well, then it means it came out of my pocket somehow. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to ask people listening to this, like, which do you think we're in right now? Which do you think is winning? I mean, it's clearly scarcity. And the reason it's scarcity is in large part because if you were an American born in the 1990s, there's like only a 50% chance you're going to do better than your parents. And it's declining all the time. You know, back when you and I were born in the 70s, that might have been an 80% chance. I mean, you know, I'm the child of immigrants. And so it was kind of presumed I was going to do better than my parents. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, it's like if I did it, it was like it was a problem in my household. So now if you have the average American waking up and being like, well, never going to own a house, can't afford to get married, you know, like no one will go on a date with me. You know, my job hasn't given me a raise and like my expenses, including my rent, keep creeping up and up. Then you wind up with a xenophobic, pessimistic electorate that then when someone like Donald Trump comes along, it's like, all right, I guess, you know, here we go, this is what I'm doing. Like this guy's going to break this machine that has been keeping me down. And so the question is, how do you make it so that people don't feel like their, you know, lives are going to be worse than their parents, et cetera, et cetera. And you have to make big moves in that direction. One of the problems in my mind is that we have fallen way behind this curve. It's taken place over years and years and years. You know, people are pissed. And so how can you address their concerns for real in a way that has them flip from scarcity to possibility? That's a lot. That's like a big leap. And one of the problems we have is that there is almost like this debt that is being built up. It makes me super sad when I see the stats around young people and their prospects for the future. You know, when I was running for president, I would say to young people, it's like, you should either be mad or sad because it's true. And then if your message is like, no, no, you should be happy and it's their fault, like then they'll be like, wait a minute, what? You know, like that's not, that, you know, isn't compelling and it's not going to bring us back together.
It definitionally is not. And I should say your work as founder of the Forward Party is trying to address these gaps. And I recommend everybody, you know, you and I can go deep on the political reforms that are absolutely necessary on this. That's actually where you and I have found a lot of common ground when we first sort of met and bonded. But zero-sum politics does not work in a democracy. This is a proper role of government to address these changes before the narcotic grievance politics leaves everybody nowhere and you get real even further destabilization. These are actions that there could and should be some bipartisan common ground on because they will address issues of stability and opportunity in a time of great transition. And it's just got to be so frustrating to have been sort of the town crier about this early on and to see not only no action being taken, but the changes occur. And then the debt situation's got worse in ways that actually make it less likely that it'll pass. But someone's got to step up and have the stones to make the case that we need this kind of change. Otherwise, there are worse things down the pike.
Yeah, poverty is the most addressable of our major problems, in my view, John. Like, poverty, we can do something about, you know? Like, some of these other things, it's like, oh, that's going to be rough. But poverty, by the numbers, it's totally addressable. There's way too much of it. And we all end up paying for it. You know, when there's some poor kid who does not get educated or, you know, isn't in the right environment or whatnot, they wind up homeless, they wind up addicted to drugs, they wind up in our criminal justice system, and then it becomes incredibly expensive. Our healthcare system, they wind up in an ER as primary care, incredibly expensive. Like, we all pay. It's one of those things where if you make an investment early, like it pays enormous dividends. And I think people know that in their own lives. I mean, like you and I are parents. And one of the reasons I ran for office was that I became a parent and I saw what was happening in our family. Yep. And then I saw what was happening in other families. And I was like, we can do better than this. Thank you for giving me this Paul Revere stature. I've been very, very saddened by what's happened over this last number of years, genuinely. It's like, you know, as the guy who did raise my hand and be like, hey, guys, AI is coming. And be like, yeah, like, isn't that interesting? Like, you know, and it's like, well, here it is. And I do think that, you know, our political culture has been eroding in part because we've let these trends have people sink into like an air of dubiousness and skepticism about a whole host of institutions, including our media. And it's been building over a period of time. It's very hard to rebuild trust after you've lost it.
So let's talk about rebuilding trust and impact on the media, particularly with regard to AI. This is a big topic, but you know, what's your broad-based policy solution for combating the flood of disinformation that could come from AI, where the cost of producing bullshit, as said on your recent podcast, is zero?
Yeah. Bullshit cheap.
Yeah.
Congratulations, everyone. We've done it. You know, John, it's one reason why I'm very glad to join you in this kind of context is that the solution is people. There are various people that other Americans look to and be like, I think most everyone's full of shit. But you know who I actually listen to? That person. And so you have to try and bring together diverse tribe of those people to say, we might not agree on everything, but we can agree on these things. And then you have at least a fighting chance. The backdrop that makes all of this much, much harder is this completely unrepresentative two-party system where everyone feels like there's this invisible line and you have to be on one side or the other. And it's only after you get beyond that could you potentially bring together a critical mass of human beings with diverse followings. And you know, I'm going to single out one group that I think is very, very disproportionately influential in this area. And some people are going to hate this, but whatever. It's comedians. You know, like the comedians completely transcend party lines. And like there are certain people, like if you look at some of the fans of these comedians, they love that comedian. They hang in there every word. They will show up to everything they do. But that to me is how you potentially try and get your way out of this. But I don't have any illusions about this. And one thing's, you know, it's like we're losing. I mean, you're just everyone should know. Like reality is losing, good guys are losing, like whatever it is. Like everyone's taking a big L because there have been these like mega trends that have been building around disintegration of trust and a bunch of other things. And so, you know, it's like you and I naturally are like, how do we rebuild trust? Because we're like positive guys. We want to have good things happen for people. But, you know, it's a dark time.
For all the macro trends that are frustrating and discouraging by any objective measure, the one thing history tells us really clearly is that the people who curl up in a fetal position when faced with great challenges, they lose.
Yeah. We're going to be the rebuilder, rekindlers.
Absolutely.
That's what this pod is, how to fix it. And you can certainly count Andrew Yang in like the Mr. Fix-It ranks.
Absolutely. You're always safest when you confront reality, but you need to do it with a sense of defiant optimism and then propose a practical plan and show where there can be some common ground that we can find because it does exist. It's just you got to push back against the zero sum of it all.
It's rally the diverse humans across party lines. That's my solution on it. And it is doable. You're right. And, you know, there are great people on quote unquote both sides of the aisle. I hate even to say that because it.
It sounds so both sidery, but the reality is we have to find ways to form broad coalitions, and that's what the Forward Party, which you founded, is dedicated to. But before we go, look, you know, one of the challenges, the macro challenge between democracy and autocracy. Autocracies always say this was true in the 30s that democracy is inefficient and that they can move more quickly. When you have the challenge of something as fast moving as AI. The way our legislation moves, it's going to be tough to keep up. So what is this idea of layered oversight to AI? How can that be not, you know, subject to regulatory capture, but how do you think AI can be regulated in a way that actually just creates clear rules of the road and guidelines so it doesn't turn into this zero sum, you know, us versus them Manichaean politics?
And you're citing my friend Gary Marcus, who is an AI expert and very positive. And one of the things that tech companies resist is like, do you really trust government to regulate this thing? And one of the things I proposed when I was running for president was that you should have a world data organization where different countries come together and have just rules of how our data gets treated. And I will be honest. I mean, you have like a US versus China competition. Mm-hmm. And so it really was who could get Europe on board. And then if you have the West, then it's who can get Latin America and Africa on board. And then you try and create an equivalent of a WTO for data. You have some international guidelines, then you have federal. One of the things I'm very excited about, honestly, is like to the extent that there could be some leadership in this space, some of the states really do have a shot at it. And if you do something, what's fascinating is the tech companies are like, oh my gosh, I have to comply with what in Illinois? In Illinois, there's a real thing, by the way. There was like a data rights case in Illinois, and I think Meta had to pay everyone. There are real actors out there, and this is, you know, one of the hopes. And then the last stand, which, by the way, I think is for the most part nonsense, it is like the industry, the consortium, the self-regulation. Like generally speaking, they won't do anything that really hurts themselves. But they can be brought to the table if the legislation is their alternative.
And this is what government is for. Look, there are a lot of leaders in AI at least say that they want regulation. They just want it to be, you know, tech forward and not, you know, sort of playing defense, but in a way that hobbles our ability to compete as this rolls out.
If I were president, John, I would have gone very, very differently on this.
How would you do it? All right, Andrew Yang wins. You're president. What's your prescription?
Yeah, so the AI guys are like, essentially like, hey, it's too complicated for you. Like, let us speed up and let us compete against China. And I'd be like, look, guys, here are my top five concerns about AI, and you have to convince me and this battery of smart people that they're being meaningfully addressed, or else you guys don't get carte blanche. So number one would be rampant identity theft. Two would be splintering of the American consciousness in the media and social media landscape. Number three is it falling into the hands of bad actors who could use it asymmetrically. Number four is displacement of workers. Like, you could reverse that and make that number one. I can just be like, start with displacement of workers, you know, and then number five would be there are certain people that are going to be like beneficiaries and other people that are left out in the cold. And like, what does that look like? Independent of jobs, like that, you know, just from like the value and the accrual. And like, you have to make the case to the random person in Iowa that's going to be good for you.
Yeah.
And the tech companies, you know, would be like, dad, don't worry about it. You have to say no. Like, unless you can actually convince us that these five things are being addressed, then you don't get the green light. And then they'd be like, but our share prices aren't going to be as high and like a bunch of other things. We have to like make all this money. And it's like, that's not my problem. Like, you know, I'm the president. They elected me to look out for them. If we're going to like, you know, blow their media landscape to smithereens and like have them be concerned that every time they get a call from their mom, it's an AI deepfake trying to spoof them out of their money or like, you know, whatever the host of problems is, like, how are you addressing that? Because, you know, you've got hundreds of billions of dollars in profit on the line. I can see that very clearly. But there are these negative externalities. The asymmetrical thing, it's like, you know, one of my friends, Tristan Harris, found that you could use AI to find out how to build a bioweapon. It's like, oh, you know, like bully for someone who wants to make a bioweapon, but, you know, like that's not exactly like it's like something we want. And that's leadership. The problem is that we have a political system where, you know, you have a leader who's like, I don't understand this stuff. Like, what's going on? You know what I'll do? And this I didn't hate. It's fine. It's like, I'm going to issue an executive order telling all my agencies to like look really hard at this and do things that will be good for us. And then the tech companies were like, okay, it's like that's not going to hold me back. So, you know, I would have had head-to-head convos with Sam and Zuck and Bezos and all these guys and been like, look, guys, like, all right, let's be real. And you're not going to snow us. So, you know, it does pain me, John. It's like, I'm not someone, you know me, like I'm not someone who goes to sleep being like, you mean I'm not president? Like, I'm not that sort of person. But some of the things I see out there, I'm just like, damn, I would have done things differently.
Well, of course you would. And this also gets to issues like the average age of Congress. You can't have leaders that don't understand the technology that's transforming the landscape. You also need to have guardrails in place so that short-term share price is not actually the marker of societal success. It's actually, you know, making sure that we're harnessing this massive change in a way that makes America the most competitive, you know, country in the world, which we are because of our natural economic ingenuity, but make sure that change is working for everybody and that we're not ashamed to talk about the common good as well as common ground. Those are things that used to be guide stars. They need to be again. And that's the opposite of a zero-sum approach to politics and the economy.
You know, when I talk about the winners and losers, John, it's like we're entering a world where certain people will never get a job interview because AI like dinged certain things about their profile, you know? And that's like where we're heading. That was like my, you know, concern number five. It's like, essentially, like companies will just start using an AI screen for everything. And then if you run afoul of one screen, you're probably going to run afoul of all the other screens too. And so it's like, oh, I'm permanently on the outside looking in. That's the kind of dystopia we're fast approaching. Sorry, I keep being a downer on this stuff.
No, look, there's about being a realist who's determined to create a better future. That's what we're about. And the whole idea is defending the idea of government of, for, and by the people. Andrew Yang, founder of the Forward Party, thank you for being an early Paul Revere advocate for taking this issue seriously. And now let's forge the solutions in addition to raising awareness. Thank you, my friend.
Let's fix it, John Avlon. Appreciate you, brother.
All right, man. Take care.